If you're building anything significant in the cloud, you really care about two big things: security and speed. And often those two things meet, sometimes collide right there in the networking layer. So today we're doing a deep dive into, the core architecture of AWS networking and also content delivery. This is really the engine that lets your applications talk securely and, globally.
That's spot on. And our mission for you, the listener, is to really get beyond just memorizing terms. We want you to grasp the architectural choices, understand the thinking behind why these AWS services exist, how they let applications connect across the world, and really form the backbone for, high-performance, solid cloud setups.
Right. And we're tackling this in two main parts. First up, building that secure, isolated network foundation, your sort of digital plot of land. And then second, how do we take what's on that secure foundation and speed up its delivery, like everywhere across the Starting with that foundation, the canvas itself, we have to begin with the Amazon Virtual Private Cloud, the VPC. I mean, pretty much every AWS resource you launch ends up living inside one of these. It's really the cornerstone of your security posture because it's your own private, isolated network bubble within the bigger AWS cloud.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Think of the whole AWS region as maybe a giant apartment building, the VPC. That's your specific apartment. You've got the keys, you control who comes in. When you create a VPC, you define its IP address range, that CIDR block, and that's your first big architectural decision. Say you choose 10 yellow 0.0.016, that gives you over 65,000 private addresses. Plenty, right? But you've got to make sure it doesn't clash with, say, your office network or maybe other VPCs you might want to connect later. It's all about planning your space carefully upfront.
Okay, so we've carved out this big block of addresses. What's the next step for making things, resilient? How do subnets fit in?
Well, subnets, they're absolutely critical because a subnet ties a specific range of those IP addresses to a single availability zone, NAZ. For high availability, and you always want that, you must spread your subnets across multiple AZ. That way, if one AZ has an issue, your resources in the subnets and other AZs just keep running. That's the core pattern for resilience right there. And we generally talk about three main types of subnets based on how they connect outwards. You've got your public subnet, that one uses an internet gateway, an IGW, to talk directly to the internet. Pretty straightforward. Then there's the private subnet. Now, this one can initiate connections going out maybe for software updates, but the internet can't initiate connections in. And finally, the isolated subnet, completely cut off, no internet path in or out, perfect for really sensitive things like your core databases, maybe.
And the route tables then act like the traffic cops, right? Directing traffic from the instances within those subnets. So for a public subnet, the route table points internet-bound traffic straight to that IGW. Okay, but hang on. If I have, say, a back-end application server in a private subnet, it needs to download security patches, right? But I definitely don't want random connections coming in from the internet. How does it get out securely?
That is the classic problem, yes. And the answer is usually a network address translation gateway or NAT gateway. The NAT gateway lives in one of your public subnets. Instances in your private subnets route their outbound internet traffic to it. The NAT gateway then forwards the request using its own public IP, gets the response, and sends it back to the correct private instance. So outbound is allowed, but no unsolicited inbound connections can reach those private instances. Now, here's a really key architectural point. You could technically set up your own EC2 instance to do this in that instance, but AWS offers the managed NAT gateway service. And honestly, it offers way better availability, much higher bandwidth, and basically zero management hassle for you. So yeah, in almost any serious setup, the managed NAT gateway is the go-to choice, even though it costs a bit more per hour. That operational reliability is usually worth it.
Okay, right. That makes sense. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, especially thinking about cost and maybe compliance. We figured out how to talk to the wider internet via the NAT gateway, but what if my private instance just needs to talk to another AWS service, like S3, for example? Why should that traffic have to hairpin out through a NAT gateway, possibly racking up data charges, just to talk to another service already inside AWS?
Exactly. It shouldn't have to. And that is precisely the purpose of VPC endpoints, often powered by something called Private Link. This is a huge architectural win. VPC endpoints let your private resources connect directly to supported AWS services, S3, DynamoDB, many others, without needing an IGW, a VPN connection, or even that NAT device. The traffic stays entirely within the secure AWS backbone network. It never touches the public internet. That's a big plus for security and often for compliance needs, too.
And I remember there are a couple of flavors of these endpoints.
Correct. There are two main types. First, interface endpoints. These essentially place an elastic network interface, an ENI, with private IP address from your subnet right into your VPC. It acts like a private entry point to the service. Then there are gateway endpoints. These are a bit simpler conceptually. They act as a target in your route table, specifically for traffic heading to S3 and DynamoDB currently. You just add a route, point it at the endpoint, and boom, traffic to S3 or DynamoDB from that subnet now goes privately. It's a really easy way to tighten access to your storage.
Okay, fantastic. So the pathways are getting clearer. Now let's talk about the final control layer inside the VPC itself, the firewalls. I see we have security groups and also network ACLs or NACLs. Why two different firewall layers? Isn't that just like more complexity to manage?
It's a great question, and it really comes down to the principle of defense in depth. You want layers. They protect things differently. They operate at different levels, and importantly, they behave differently. So security groups act at the instance level. Think of them as the firewall attached directly to your server's virtual network card. And the absolute key thing to remember, they are stateful. If you allow inbound traffic on, say, port 80 for web traffic, the return traffic going back out is automatically permitted. You don't need a separate outbound rule for the reply. They're mostly about allowing specific traffic to an instance.
Okay, stateful at the instance level. What about the second layer, the NACLs?
Right, the Network Access Control List, or NACL. This one operates at the subnet level. So it's like a guard at the entrance to the entire neighborhood, not just one house. It affects all instances within that subnet. And the crucial difference here, NACLs are stateless. If you allow inbound traffic on port 80, you must also explicitly create an outbound rule to allow the return traffic on the appropriate ephemeral ports. And maybe even more importantly, NACLs support explicit deny rules. Security groups only have allow rules, so use both together. The NACL can block broad ranges of unwanted traffic at the subnet boundary, maybe deny all traffic from a known bad IP range. Then the security group allows only the specific necessary traffic to the individual instance. It's layered security.
Perfect. That clears it up. So the VPC is our isolated secure canvas. We build it with resilience using AZs and subnets. We control traffic flow with route tables, IGWs, NAT gateways, and those private VPC endpoints. And we lock it down with two layers of firewalls, stateful security groups and stateless NACLs. The house is built and secured. Now let's tackle that global challenge. Our application is running happily and securely in a VPC, maybe in Virginia, but our user, they're trying to access it from, say, Japan. That physical distance, that's a huge problem for latency, right? How do we fix that?
That distance is absolutely the killer for perceived performance in modern web applications. And the standard solution is, well, you don't move the server. You move the content closer to the user. You use a content delivery network, a CDN. And within AWS, the service for this is Amazon CloudFront. It's a massive globally distributed network of servers. Its whole job is to securely deliver your data, static files, videos, APIs, entire applications with really low latency, super fast, no matter where your end users actually are.
Okay, walk us through how that actually works. Where does the data live initially, and how does CloudFront make it fast?
So it starts with your origin server. This is the definitive source of your content. It could be an S3 bucket holding website files, maybe an EC2 instance running your application, or even an Elastic Load Balancer distributing traffic to multiple servers. CloudFront then relies on its network of edge locations. These are hundreds of smaller data centers AWS has placed strategically all around the world, usually very close to major population centers and internet exchange points.
Ah, so when my user in Japan makes a request, instead of that request traveling all the way across the Pacific to Virginia.
Exactly. The request gets intelligently routed by DNS to the nearest CloudFront edge location, perhaps one in Tokyo.
And then what happens at that edge location?
That's where the magic of caching comes in. If another user nearby recently requested the same file, say a company logo image, a CSS file, maybe even a common API result, it might already be stored or cached at that Tokyo Edge location. If it is cached, CloudFront serves it immediately from Tokyo. That request travels maybe tens of miles instead of thousands. Latency just plummets. If it's not in the cache yet, a cache miss, the edge location goes and fetches it from your origin server in Virginia, stores it in its cache for next time, and then delivers it to the user in Japan.
The speed benefit is obvious. What are the other big wins for someone using CloudFront?
Oh, there's several key benefits. First, as we said, performance and global reach. It's just faster for almost everyone. Second, security is a big one. CloudFront integrates tightly with AWS Way, the web application firewall. So you can filter out common attacks like SQL injection or cross-site scripting right at the edge before they even get near your origin. Plus, things like HTTP SSL are standard and you can do geo-restrictions blocking access from certain countries. Third, cost optimization. Think about it. Every request served from the edge cache is a request your origin server doesn't have to handle. That reduces load on your EC2 instances or ELBs. And crucially, data transfer out from an AWS region can be expensive. Data transfer out from CloudFront edge locations is often much cheaper, so it can save you significant money.
Yeah, I remember hearing about folks using it not just for static stuff like images, but to accelerate dynamic API calls too. They saw huge latency drops for international users just by routing API traffic through CloudFront.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even for dynamic content, CloudFront optimizes the network path back to your origin. But you also get fine-grained control. You can use cache behaviors to customize how things are cached. You can define the time to live, the TTL, how long content stays cached. You can control whether things like query strings or cookies are forwarded to the origin, which is essential for personalized content. Lots of levers to pull there.
But the feature that seems like a real game changer, the real aha moment for developers lately, seems to be Lambda at Edge. What's that about?
Yeah. Lambda Edge is incredibly powerful. It lets you run small snippets of code. AWS Lambda functions directly at the CloudFront Edge locations, close to the user. Think about the possibilities. Before the request even hits your main application, you could resize images on the fly based on the user's device type detected from request headers. Or you could run A/B testing logic right at the edge, routing users to different versions. Or perform custom authentication checks. Or even generate simple responses directly from the edge without ever bothering your origin. You're essentially pushing compute logic out to the very perimeter of the network. It maximizes speed and efficiency for certain tasks. This really transforms CloudFront from just a caching layer into, a kind of globally distributed compute platform. It enables really advanced use cases, super fast serverless websites, smooth video streaming, accelerating mobile app APIs, all sorts of things.
Okay, wow. That really brings us nicely to the end of this deep dive then. We started by laying that secure network foundation with VPC. We looked at subnets, how traffic gets in and out securely with things like NAT gateways, and the efficiency and security boost from VPC endpoints. Then we moved on to accelerating content globally using CloudFront, leveraging those edge locations and caching, plus the power of Lambda at Edge.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
Well, truly understanding these two core components, VPC for the foundation, CloudFront for the delivery, it's just non-negotiable. If you want to build anything robust, scalable, and secure on AWS, from a simple website to a complex global application, you need to have a solid grasp of these networking and content delivery principles. Right. And to leave you with something to chew on, a final provocative thought. We talked about security groups being stateful firewalls at the instance level and NACLs being stateless firewalls at the subnet level, with that power to explicitly deny traffic. So think about this. When designing your security, is it enough to rely just on the stateful allow rules of security groups around your critical servers? Or should you also be using restrictive stateless NACLs one layer up, explicitly denying anything not expressly permitted to enforce a stricter default deny posture at the subnet boundary? How does that stateless deny capability change your defense in-depth strategy? Something to keep digging into.